Welcome to Brain Ignition Radio. Here I share with you all of the knowledge and resources I've gained as it relates to nutrition, exercise, and brain health. By sharing these interesting case studies, in-depth discussions, and research, I hope that we can learn together and improve our current health and the health of future generations. I'm your host, Chet Binning, and I thank you for tuning in. Welcome, everyone. Thank you again for tuning in to another episode of Brain Ignition Radio. Today, we're going to talk about vitamin D as it relates to mental health and depression and just overall health in general. There's a lot of really interesting things to touch on when it comes to vitamin D. So exactly what we will talk about today is the research showing the links between low levels of vitamin D and risk of depression. We'll talk about where we can get vitamin D and what exactly it does, including how it affects things like insulin sensitivity or even fat loss. We'll discuss whether or not we can get sufficient amounts in the winter. And if we are relying on summertime, how much sun exposure do we really need? And what other factors affect this, including sunscreen and skin color? We'll also discuss diet and whether or not we can get meaningful amounts of vitamin D2 or D3 from our diet and what the difference is between this D2 and D3. And of course, we'll also cover supplementation, what the research suggests is optimal dosing, and is vitamin D toxicity a real concern? So let's start off with another quick review of last episode, because yet again, there is some important things that will carry over into this episode. There's a lot of overlap always, and that's good. I think that ties things together, but it makes sense because all of these things are related, right? So last episode, we focused on protein in our diet and specifically the amino acids we get from that protein and how that influences our brain health and brain function. So specifically, we focused on the amino acids like phenylalanine, tyrosine, and tryptophan, and how those impact the levels of neurotransmitters in our brain, like dopamine and serotonin. So these two neurotransmitters in particular, because of the amount of research that shows that low levels of these neurotransmitters, so dopamine and serotonin, or just some type of dysfunction of these, is often associated with depression. And like we talked about last time, that's of course why there's been some, or I should say the majority of drugs designed to target depression actually target this exact mechanism. So they attack or target these neurotransmitter systems. So if you guys haven't listened to that episode already, definitely go back and check that out. We talk about how diet and the specific foods from diet that impact these neurotransmitters. So what foods to get, the best time to consume these. One thing I realized after recording last episode was that I didn't do a very good job of summarizing example foods or meals. There was a couple examples, but I don't think a ton. Bad habit of mine, right? I kind of go into these details and mechanisms and then sometimes forget to talk about just simply and in a practical sense, how can we actually apply this? So like I said, there's a few in there, but probably not enough. But that being said, what I am going to do, guys, is at the end of this series, I'm going to put together some type of summary. I haven't decided yet whether that will be a mini ebook, or I think I'll probably do a condensed video where I review all of this and probably post that on Instagram or social media somewhere that just kind of ties everything together. But I do think it would be also valuable to have a bit of a written summary. So here's the foods we talked about, the best time for these, any particular nutrients or supplements we discussed. But if you guys have any suggestions at all for summarizing that and getting it out, let me know. Let me know how you want to see that, because that's what's most important to me. What is going to be easiest for you guys to actually use and apply? Now let's kick things off with some good questions I got regarding vitamin D. The first one is, can I take vitamin D before bed? So this is a good question. Timing is not all that critical when it comes to supplementation of vitamin D. And that's because this is a fat soluble vitamin. In fact, it's as we'll talk about, it's really a fat soluble hormone. It's kind of a it's funny. I mean, we call it a vitamin, but it's really not. It's more of a hormone. That's not anyone's mistake. It's just kind of something that's emerging as we learn more and more about vitamin D, and we'll talk a little bit about this. But ultimately, it's fat soluble, which means we store it for long periods of time in our fat tissue. It's not something that's used up every single day, such as an electrolyte or a mineral would be. So something like sodium and magnesium, you're using that up day in, day out. We excrete it in our urine. There's different lifestyle factors that will cause us to immediately excrete some, for example. So coffee actually forces the body to excrete more magnesium in the urine. So that's just an example of how something on a daily basis has an immediate impact on the levels. Vitamin D, because it's stored in our fat tissue, we don't actually have to take it every single day. So that's something right there, right? So people, as I understand, with supplements, usually convenience is a factor. So just remembering to take something, right? And so here's one thing you can really take advantage of this. If you find it difficult to regularly take your vitamin D, remember this, know that you don't actually have to take it every single day because it is stored in your body. It's fat soluble. And so that's why you'll see a lot of research use really large doses, and they'll only use it, for instance, weekly or every other day, or sometimes you'll even see monthly. So a really common dose you'll see, and one that's used in some of the research we'll talk about later on, is actually 50,000 IU weekly. So that would be about a little over 7,000 per day. But you can do that if convenience is an issue for you, if you know, remembering to take it is an issue for you, or if you just want to make things easier. I mean, it's easier to take it one time than every single day, right? And so if you have your daily dose determined, which we're going to talk about as well, you could just do that. You could multiply it by 7, take that one time a week. And so to answer this initial question, can we take it before bed? I don't really see an issue with this, no, because like I said, it is stored for long periods of time. So I'm not aware of any problems with doing this. However, I will say that I like to take it in the morning, and this is just kind of my personal preference. The reason I do this is because I think about the sun and how that affects us. The sun, of course, is the major source of vitamin D for us. And if we think about times when we're getting the majority of our sun exposure, oftentimes it's probably earlier in the morning, I would think. Like, we're probably not going to get a lot of sun exposure right before bed. Again, there's not even necessarily a lot of data to support this. I just think, you know, this seems to make sense. I shouldn't say there's any data on this. There's a little bit. So there's, as an example, there's some research that looks at how different breakfasts or meals affect our rates of fat oxidation throughout the rest of the day. So basically how it affects fat metabolism in the body. There is some interesting data showing that increasing our vitamin D intake at breakfast can enhance thermogenesis throughout the rest of the day. That's compared to a meal that's low in vitamin D. And so I just kind of take this into consideration. Again, it's definitely not a critical thing. The most important thing here is that you get enough. And then I just kind of do it at this time because I think, hey, it seems to make sense. But ultimately, I don't think it's a big deal. And then the other really good question was, do I need to take K2 with my vitamin D? So you'll see supplements that are vitamin D and K2. So this is important only if you consume a diet that's low in K2. So of course you can't know that unless you get it tested. But there is a couple risk factors. The biggest one being is a low fat diet. So if you follow a low fat diet, then your risk for K2 deficiency is higher. The most common sources or the foods with the highest amounts of K2 per serving, I should say, are dark poultry, like chicken, turkey, butter, really good source of K2, actually. That means ghee as well. Green leafy vegetables, so your arugula, spinach, watercress, and then egg yolks are a really good source of K2 as well. So if you're consuming these semi-regularly, you're probably okay. Now, I should mention this is a little bit more nuanced, but healthy gut microbiome is also very important for actually getting K2 from your foods. Again, you can't really know this for sure without doing an abundance of testing, but I just want to mention that because it is important. And so ultimately you don't need this unless you are fitting into some of these risk factor categories or not eating these foods. And then actually magnesium is also required for metabolism of vitamin D. So I really want to mention that because we know that magnesium deficiency is really common. This is incredibly common. I've talked about this a lot before. So that's another thing to consider. We haven't talked about magnesium yet, but it's another one that is critical for depression and just brain health in general. This is another one that you can get tested pretty easily. I'm going to have mine tested. I plan to go at the end of this week, so I should have the results in a couple weeks. I'm going to get a lot of the stuff we've talked about tested, and then I'm going to actually review that on the episode, and I think it'll be cool for you guys just learning basically how we can apply them. So magnesium, also important. Now, vitamin D, what does this actually do? So I mentioned that it's really a hormone. There's actually vitamin D receptors in every single organ throughout the human body. So that's amazing, isn't it? But that's what tells us that it's really more of a hormone. So hormones bind to these receptors. We know neurotransmitters do the same as well in the brain, but hormones, kind of simply put, and you can think of this when you think about like testosterone or estrogen or thyroid hormone or insulin or whatever. Hormones typically travel long distances in the body. So they'll travel through your bloodstream in order to eventually bind to a receptor wherever it is in your body. And so all of our organs have receptors for vitamin D. That tells us right there. I mean, of course, that tells us that vitamin D must be important. It does something. It has all these receptors. It must be important. Now, some other roles of vitamin D. Actually, before I jump into that, I want you guys to think about when you're thinking about vitamin D or hormone D, as it's often called, think about this as coming from the sun. Think about this as the major source for this is the sun. I think we have a tendency to, when we hear vitamin D, we just automatically revert to thinking about basically supplementation, right? That's where our mind goes all the time. But it's the sun, guys. The sun is the most prevalent source of vitamin D, the most important source. So when you're thinking about this, I do think it helps to just imagine that. So imagine that you're outside, you're getting sun exposure. It depends on the year, but that sun hits your skin. And then eventually that UVA, UVB is ultimately metabolized into vitamin D, and that travels throughout your entire body to do all kinds of important things. So that's the way you guys should think about this. Now, of course, you know that vitamin D is also important for bone health and prevention of injury. That's because it is also working alongside other nutrients like calcium and phosphorus, which are, of course, important for bone health. There is some interesting data actually showing that risk of injury among athletes is sometimes higher with vitamin D deficiency. So this is some of the interesting research that's out there. Now, we also know that vitamin D is absolutely critical for the immune system, just essential. And I think we're all probably well aware of this now. I would hope with everything that's gone on with COVID, we've seen the data and we've seen the stats about the increased risk of just death and poor outcome with low levels of vitamin D. I mean, it's profound. Some research suggests as high as 9 of 10 deaths related to COVID are in patients with vitamin D deficiency. Now, we have to be careful with that. We can't say that vitamin D was the cause, but it's clearly, like I said, it's important here and we can't ignore it. So that's just some of the really profound statistics, but we know that it is important for the immune system. It's involved in inflammation and our inflammatory response. That's going to come up later as well. If you guys remember our episode about inflammation and neuroinflammation, so vitamin D is important here. Some of the coolest data on vitamin D. This is something I've been digging into a lot more recently, is the importance of vitamin D for the gut, actually. So there's some really fascinating data showing that deficient levels or low levels, because there is a difference, of vitamin D compromises our gut and our gut lining. So this is pretty crazy. If you've never heard this before, there's research that shows as we restore levels of vitamin D, it restores the integrity of our gut lining. So something that's come up, I would say just kind of randomly in the past couple episodes, if I recall, is this idea of gut permeability or leaky gut. So this is where we have this, just this separation in these tight junctions in our gut lining, which allows bacteria from our gut to get out into the rest of our general circulation. And this really ramps up inflammation throughout the entire body and the brain. So this is not a good thing. What this is saying is that we're more prone to this if our vitamin D is low. On the other hand, if we replete vitamin D, so if we restore the levels, it can actually address this gut permeability. So that right there is an exact way that vitamin D can actually mitigate inflammation. So really interesting stuff. There's some data showing that vitamin D in the gut is also important for the actual ability for us to get B vitamins from our food, but also to create B vitamins in our gut. This is another really cool kind of nuanced thing that's newly emerging. But that's another thing. Imagine that, our ability to have sufficient levels of B vitamins throughout our body might also be impacted by having adequate levels of vitamin D. And this is why I say, when you think about vitamin D, think about it coming from the sun. I think when we talk about all these roles of vitamin D, it sounds a little bit crazy at first if we just think of it as a vitamin, but if we start to think about it as, oh, it comes from the sun, that must be pretty important. Now I understand why it's involved in so many different things. Vitamin D also affects neurotransmitters in the brain. We're going to talk about this as well. And then it's also associated with, so that is low levels and deficient vitamin D is associated with so many chronic illnesses. We talked about COVID, but also cardiovascular disease, hypertension, obesity, atherosclerosis. Not sure why I pronounce it like that. Even things like type 2 diabetes, insulin resistance, our tolerance to glucose, all of this is affected by vitamin D. There's even some cool data showing that our fat metabolism is also affected by vitamin D. So one study, and some of this, mind you, is preclinical data. So it's, again, it's a tough thing to test in humans, but as I've said before, we still need to talk about this because this is before human data. We have this preclinical data and mechanistic data. That's how we get to the human data. And there's research that shows that triglyceride accumulation was decreased by 50% when fat cells were treated with vitamin D. So that's pretty cool. So imagine that in the lab, they isolate individual fat cells. So this is a pretty common technique, is to isolate certain cell types just to figure out how they work. So when we isolate fat cells, the accumulation of triglycerides, so we know that accumulating triglycerides in fat cells, not a good thing, right? That's what makes them grow and ultimately what causes us to gain fat. Well, having sufficient vitamin D decreased this accumulation of triglyceride by 50%. And then another one actually found that vitamin D interferes with the growth of fat cells. So when you gain weight, put on fat, get that extra flub around the midsection, this is interfered with by vitamin D at a cellular level. So it does a lot of cool things. Now, a lot of this stuff, again, we don't necessarily know if it's like a chicken or an egg type thing. We don't know what precisely came first. So something like the COVID, we don't know what came first. Was it the COVID that drove down that's probably not a good example. Let's use instead the cardiovascular disease. We don't know if having the cardiovascular disease drove down vitamin D or if being deficient in vitamin D contributed to the progression of cardiovascular disease. So we don't necessarily know here. These are some things that are still being figured out. That's why I emphasize a lot of this is association, which we've also talked about before. If you're not sure what I'm talking about, just go back and listen to my previous episodes. I think it was episode 1 or 2, where I talk about the difference between association studies and intervention studies. But still, there's clearly an enormous amount of data showing the importance of vitamin D, and low levels are associated with all of these different chronic illnesses. So we definitely want to support vitamin D levels. Now, of course, the focus of today's discussion is how vitamin D affects mental health and depression. So there's been a lot of research on this. The first one that we're going to talk about, this was a study in Iceland looking at older adults. So it was adults over the age of 65, I believe. They're often used in these clinical studies as they're at a higher risk of vitamin D deficiency. So So what they found was that there was an increased risk of depression with vitamin D status below 50 nanomoles per liter. So what does that number mean? So if you guys were to go to like a Life Labs right now, or if you were to go to your doctor and have your vitamin D tested, they would give you a range. And the range is typically in Canada, it's 75 to 250 nanomoles per liter. That's NMOL-L, and that's all lowercase. You may also see, I don't think this is used often in Canada, but just in case you guys see this, you might see nanograms per milliliter. So NG-milliliter. I'm going to focus on the nanomoles today because, like I said, I think that's what is typically used in Canada. I don't think the other is often used. So if you go to something like Life Labs or Dynacare, this is what you're going to see. So 50 nanomoles, that's important because that's below the cutoff, right? So this would be flagged, hopefully, if you were to get a test done in Canada. This is really, really low. So even the low end of our range, about 75, based on the research, I would still consider that low. So if you're below this even, that is, it's very low. And in fact, they, after this, they then separated this group into those that were below even 30 nanomolars. And they found that they were twice as likely to be currently depressed compared with the other men with adequate levels. And sorry, this particular one was focused on elderly men. So the risk of depression was twice as likely under 30 compared to those over 50. And like I said, even over 50, if you're at 50, that's still really, really low. But even that, those 20 points here is making a big difference. Another study, this was again, an elderly population, this time in Brazil. And they found that there was a 2.27 times increased risk of depression with insufficient levels. Now, there is a ton of different studies that look at this exact same thing. As is often the case, you will not find a consistent result. So what I mean by that is you will not see in every single study that vitamin D is associated with depression, or that supplementation of vitamin D when it is deficient improves depression. So you're not going to see that in every single study. However, if you look at this, I'm going to post the references to these particular studies, and they actually cite a couple, what I would call summaries in the papers. So a summary of all of the other studies that have been done that ask this exact same question. But the point here, the takeaway is that the overwhelming conclusion of all these studies, so these two, but also all of the other ones that have been done, is that vitamin D levels are associated with depression, and restoring vitamin D levels, either with exposure to sun or supplementation, improves this. It improves the outcome. Like I said, you're not going to see it every single time, but we have to look at what's called the totality of data. What is the overwhelming conclusion when we look at all of this and consider it together? When we consider it with the preclinical data, that looks at mechanisms, the interventional data, and it shows that, yes, vitamin D is vital here. Let's jump into some of the mechanisms now, shall we? So why might we see this in the research? So why is there such a strong association between vitamin D and depression? What is it actually doing specifically in the brain that it might have this impact? Now, before we jump in, of course, there's kind of the obvious answer here, and that is just that we're not getting as much sunshine. We know that being out in the sun, it feels good. you know, puts us in a good mood. It's usually in the summer. We're outside with friends, drinking, whatever. So that's one possible answer here. But the other thing we need to consider here is that what's actually happening when we do that? What's actually happening when we're outside more? Well, we're getting more vitamin D. And so can that explain some of this positive mood that we experience? Well, absolutely, it could, for sure. So that's just something to think about. But the first one here is that there's about four different major arguments here, if you will, or four different mechanisms that we should identify. The first one is that there is receptors for vitamin D throughout many parts of the brain. So this would include the limbic system, cerebellum, cortex, but these are all areas that are really important for controlling behavior and basically emotions and mood. The second, and one that we've really already talked about, is that there are lower levels of vitamin D in depressed people compared to controls without depression. So this is a very common finding, like we discussed. Now the third and fourth, in my opinion, are where things get really interesting. Before I jump into these guys, I just want to quickly back up. When we think about that rationale for being outside, being in the sun, we also need to think about research from northern climates. So particularly these Scandinavian countries, I know there's been studies in Norway. If that was the reason, the primary reason is that the amount of sun exposure, well, then we would expect to see rates of depression exponentially higher in these countries, right? Because we know that certain parts of the year, they're getting a couple hours of sun and that's it. Now, we don't typically see that. We don't typically see elevated rates of depression in these regions. And so what that tells us is that it's not just a factor of being outside and feeling good because you're in the sun. Maybe there actually is a specific role here of vitamin D, which we can get from the sun, but maybe it's also coming from the vitamin D that we can get from diet or that we can supplement, or the vitamin D that we get from the sun, but that the body will store. And so that's an interesting point that I forgot to mention earlier, is that if we use the example of our vitamin D levels this time of year, this is an interesting time of year. Even though the sun has started to shine a little bit more, it's started to warm up a little bit. Theoretically, this would be the time of year where we're actually likely to be lowest in vitamin D. It's because we're the farthest away from summer sun. That was several months ago. You get a ton of vitamin D throughout the summer, your body stores it, and then you kind of have it as a reserve throughout the winter, right? But this time of year, we're so far away from that summer sun that we're becoming lower. So this is technically probably the time of year when, again, theoretically, based on the science, we would expect to have the lowest levels, even if we are getting daily sun in the wintertime, because that's critical as well. The sun is not the same. It just has to do with our latitude and the angle of the sun. Now, if we get back to these mechanisms, covered point one, point two, point three. This is a really interesting one because it ties in our discussion of amino acids and protein last time. So vitamin D in the brain actually regulates the synthesis of serotonin. Serotonin, we talked about this a ton last episode. So if you guys don't know why I'm bringing this up and why it's so important, go back and check that out. But it turns out that the synthesis of serotonin, so the actual formation of serotonin in your brain, requires vitamin D. So specifically, vitamin D actually activates the gene that makes the enzyme tryptophan hydroxylase 2, or TPH2, And this is what converts the essential amino acid tryptophan, which we get from diet, into serotonin in the brain. So in other words, we need a specific enzyme to convert tryptophan, which you're going to get from poultry or some of the other sources we talked about, chicken and so on. You need this enzyme to efficiently convert that tryptophan into serotonin in your brain to make you feel good. And what does this enzyme require? Well, it requires the help of vitamin D. Vitamin D literally activates it. So that's a really cool explanation right there, a really cool mechanism. And then the fourth one, I find this one even more interesting, and it's the important role of vitamin D in influencing our immune system. That includes inflammation and inflammation in the brain. So again, if you guys don't know why I'm talking about this one, I would go back and listen to my episode on inflammation and neuroinflammation in the brain. It was the first episode I did in this series, I do believe. I'll link it in the show notes. I hope I'm right on that, but I think it was the first episode in this series. We talked about how high levels of inflammation and high levels of inflammation in the brain increase the risk of depression. And we cover all the different mechanisms as to how and why that happens. So here's a couple ways vitamin D influences this. So for one, vitamin D, specifically the receptor, is involved in blocking inflammation in different immune functions. So like I mentioned, high inflammation, excess inflammation, we know that significantly increases risk of depression. Well, it turns out that the vitamin D receptor is involved in actually mitigating this inflammation. And this also happens in your gastrointestinal tract. So this happens within your gut even, guys. This is really cool stuff, I think. So we can also go back to our discussion about the gut that we had a little bit earlier on. So what's one of the ways that we can increase inflammation throughout the body, which can increase our risk for mental health or even depression? Well, it's having a compromised gut, and specifically having a compromised gut lining, which we talked about earlier. And one of the things that compromises that gut lining, well, it's just high levels of inflammation within our GI. So within our digestive system, high levels of inflammation can increase the risk of this. And so what this is saying is that vitamin D helps to mitigate this. And this is precisely what we were talking about earlier. It's that vitamin D can actually restore that gut barrier, and also the mucus that lines that gut barrier, that builds that gut barrier. So these are all really important things for really controlling inflammation throughout the body and just having a healthy immune system in general. Because we know that the majority of your immune system is actually concentrated in your gut. And so controlling inflammation here through diet, through exercise, by getting adequate nutrients, by getting enough sleep and good sleep, by controlling stress, all of these things are going to support your gut. And vitamin D is another one that does that. Now, speaking of stress, low vitamin D can actually worsen our response to stress. So you're maybe wondering how does all of this fit within the same hypothesis, which is number four. So remember, we went 1, 2, 3, 4 in how vitamin D impacts depression. Well, it's because stress and inflammation in some instances work hand in hand. So this is still the same point. So just so that we're keeping track here. But it turns out the low vitamin D will actually exacerbate your stress response. So when we talk about things like tolerance to stress, this is a real phenomenon, guys. There's a reason, there's many reasons why some people feel more resilient to stress than others. There's a reason why some people get cut off in traffic and start honking on the horn and flipping everyone the bird, cranking the tunes and throwing on the heavy metal just because they're so angry. And then why others, they just don't really care. It just doesn't even affect them. And they just kind of go on with their day. So there is some specific mechanisms behind this. And one of this, like I said, could be low vitamin D. So specifically, having lower levels of vitamin D will actually increase what's called CRH in response to stress. So this is known as corticotropin, releasing hormone. This is released from a specific area of your brain known as the hypothalamus. It sits roughly above the roof of your mouth, very small structure. This region releases CRH, which leads to the eventual release of cortisol from your adrenal glands. And your adrenal glands, remember, sit atop of both of your kidneys. So this is a specific pathway that is triggered or stimulated when you must deal with stress or when you're stressed out. So when you get the sweaty palms, the dilated pupils, racing heart, and you feel stressed or anxious, this is one of the things that's going on. Your hypothalamus releases this CRH, which then travels to your adrenal glands atop your kidneys and then triggers the release of cortisol and adrenaline and some other chemicals to help you combat that stress. And the point of this is that lower vitamin D will actually lead to a greater release of CRH. So a stronger signal to respond to stress. This isn't, in most cases, not a good thing. You don't want an elevated response or an exaggerated response, because we know that this leads to a number of different health issues. So by controlling or having sufficient vitamin D, we can even impact how we cope with stress and how our body copes with stress. Another really interesting thing that kind of ties some of this together. So we mentioned magnesium earlier. Well, another thing that actually can exacerbate or worsen this stress response is actually deficient magnesium. So you can see how all of this stuff is connected, right? We're kind of starting to connect the dots here. If someone is deficient in magnesium, we talked about vitamin D, but if we're deficient in magnesium, this is why we're going to experience more stress. Whereas if we support our magnesium levels, which we can do with supplementation, if we're deficient, we're going to be more tolerant or more resilient to stress with healthy magnesium. Now, the reason this whole stress response is important as it relates to depression is, of course, because we know that these are often associated. So greater activation of our stress response often happens hand in hand with depression. So those are kind of the basic mechanisms and hypotheses about why we see so much data on vitamin D and depression. So these are some of the things that explain why that might be there. So we're going to wrap things up today with a focus on supplementation and dosing and this possible issue of toxicity. So can we take too much? So just remember the first thing I said about vitamin D supplementation earlier on, and that was an amount that's often used in clinical studies is that 50,000 per week. And this is roughly about 7,000 per day. Now, this is, of course, not every single study, but this is important because this is pretty dramatically different than what we would see as a recommendation on a product label, right? If you were to buy vitamin D at the grocery store or your supplement store, you're going to see a recommendation that is a lot lower than this. The most common one you'll see is about 600 IU per day, I believe. Now, the key here is that for most people, again, I'm not a doctor. I'm not here to treat, cure, or prevent illness. You guys are responsible for your health, not me. This is just based on the research, but for most people, 600 IU per day is not going to be enough. It's not going to do really anything to your vitamin D. It might move the needle a little bit, but if you're deficient and in that low range, so 50 nanomoles per liter or even 30, like we talked about in that one study, this is not going to be sufficient to restore your levels to optimal. And they've actually done these studies where they supplement individuals who are deficient with vitamin D just to see how much is required. Now, there was one example study. This was in Canadian adults by Ekwaru et al. That's E-K-W-A-R-U et al. This was published in PLOS One or PLOS One, which is P-L-O-S One, a pretty good journal, really pretty decent journal. And they found that for individuals who were deficient, 20,000 IUs of vitamin D3 daily was what was required to increase their levels up to 150 nanomole per liters. So if you think back to the range, it was 75 to 250. You probably want to get up into that, you know, 120 or plus range to move towards optimal. There's a big, big difference between deficiency, low levels, and then optimal. Unfortunately, our RDIs, our recommended daily intakes, or even a lot of the lab work showing you the range, unfortunately, it doesn't make this designation between deficient and optimal. So the point of this is that you might be, you could be at 76 nanomole per liter and be just fine according to that lab test, because it's not going to be flagged. You're not below that 75 number. But really, what's the difference between 76 and say 74? So you want to get up into that kind of mid to higher range of that reference range. It goes up to 250, remember? Now, more is not always necessarily better, but for vitamin D, it seems like we want to get up into that to that mid range. And to get there, you need these higher doses. But even just to get into healthy levels, so to not be deficient, the majority of the research shows that we need these higher doses. That's why they're using these 50,000 IU per week, which is one of the most common doses in the research. And that's about 7,000 per day. Now, of course, I can't give you guys recommendations. I don't know what the best dose is for you. You have to get tested. That's really the only way to know here for sure. Get your levels tested. This should be the easiest marker to get tested. Your medical doctor should do this, I hope, especially based on kind of everything that's going on right now, and especially living in Canada. I know that's not always the case, but it's really the only way to know. But some other things that you guys can consider if you can't get that test done, and maybe you're wondering, this is another thing I'm going to have tested in 1 week and then hopefully get the results a couple weeks later. So it'll be really interesting to see. But you want to consider your summer sun exposure. So if you're someone who's outside a lot in the summer with minimal clothes on, you're going to have greater storage of vitamin D that you can draw upon throughout the winter. Skin color is also really important here. So individuals with darker skin actually need more vitamin D. Diet is important here as well. So not that diet is a big contributor to our vitamin D levels, but it gives us some. So some of the highest sources of vitamin D in our diet would be egg yolks, give us a little. Some whole dairy can give us some. So we're talking about things like cream and whole milk. Cod liver is probably the highest dietary source of vitamin D, or cod liver oil, actually. And then what about sun in the winter? So we mentioned this briefly earlier. There is a couple studies showing that we can probably maintain vitamin D above that marker of deficiency if we're outside a lot in the summer, in the winter, even in a somewhat northern climate. So the studies I'm thinking of were, I think in Northern England, and they did find that if individuals were outside for longer periods of time in the winter, I can't remember how long it was, that some people, not everyone, are able to maintain above deficient levels of vitamin D. And actually the study I'm thinking of, I believe they found that they did divide the individuals in the group by skin color, because I mean, in this example, it is important because we know that our ability to synthesize vitamin D differs. And they found that those in the study of Asian descent were more likely to be deficient than the Caucasians in the study. So that's another important thing to consider. And when we talk about exposure to sunshine, we also need to consider how much sunscreen we wear, because we know that that's going to block our synthesis of vitamin D. And then of course, like I already mentioned, skin exposure. So going outside with just your eyes and nose showing, not the same as going outside in shorts and a t-shirt, for sure. So I think we already covered the levels pretty good, guys. As always, let me know if you have any questions about that. We should close with a mention of toxicity, I think. So is this really a concern when we're supplementing vitamin D? Is toxicity an issue? I posted something to my Instagram, this was probably several months ago by now, but about this toxicity issue, because it was something that I kept seeing pop up in the media as it relates to COVID. And it was just beyond infuriating and frustrating, was that the major claim in the media, so even on CBC, I remember very clearly, they really downplayed the importance of vitamin D in all of this. And I just could not believe it. It was so frustrating. They downplayed the importance of vitamin D. And one of the ways they did this was by really emphasizing the risk of toxicity from vitamin D supplementation, which in my opinion is just absolutely ridiculous. The amount of vitamin D you have to supplement to get into this toxicity range is just enormous. I mean, I showed you the study earlier that found that 20,000 IUs daily was only enough to restore people to that middle of the range, to 150 nanomoles. The range goes up to 250. We think that toxicity of vitamin D starts around 500 and is most commonly found above 750 nanomoles. So the amount of vitamin D you would have to supplement to get there, I have no idea how much you would have to take. There is some studies out there who have experimented with this, but I can't remember the precise numbers. I know that it was an astronomical dose. I think one was 60,000 IUs in, I think it was in children. So in young children, where body size does matter here, guys. So the larger you are, the more you require. And that's just an enormous dose. So the point here is that I really don't think toxicity is an issue here. I can't believe that this was being promoted. But as we've discussed before, there's just kind of some unfortunate discussions about food and exercise and nutrient intake and just natural healthy lifestyle interventions for not only outcome from COVID, but just for optimal health in general. Unfortunately, we just don't get an accurate message in the media, unfortunately. So the last thing I should mention, guys, is that you will see vitamin D3 versus D2. So those food sources I mentioned earlier, those are sources of D3. The sun, that's a source of D3. You'll see some supplements that give us D2. Or for instance, something like mushrooms, that gives us a little bit of D2. But it's not quite the same. We want D3. So the body's better at using D3 than it is D2. That's not to say the D2 isn't isn't useful. It certainly can be, but the D3 is going to be more effective. So that's everything for today, guys. If you have any questions about any of this, let me know. I think we're going to wrap this up, this series that is, next week with a discussion on magnesium. There's definitely a couple other nutrients, and in fact, even really important lifestyle factors that I would love to add to this. I just am undecided right now whether to continue this or focus on something new. One of those would be the importance of our circadian rhythm, specifically really our sleep-wake cycle. So classic example being shift work as something that really disrupts our sleep-wake cycle. Well, this is another thing that is just critical for brain function. But as always, please just let me know if you guys have any recommendations, any questions, any complaints. After all, I am putting this out there for you, so I want you guys to benefit the most. So let me know what you want to hear. Otherwise, that's it for today, guys. Thank you very much for tuning in. Hope you guys have a healthy week, and I look forward to the next one.